Hello and welcome to Life, Lemons and the Law, a Clark Wilmot podcast series discussing life-changing experiences of all kinds with those people who've undergone those experiences. We'll talk about what caused the events, the immediate impact, and the long-term, often positive consequences. On this first episode, we have Martin Palmer and Beth Evans, and we're going to be talking about their life-changing experiences with regard to their own mental health. Martin, can you please introduce yourself, say who you are and what it is that you do?
Hi there. Afternoon. I'm Martin Palmer, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Business Development at Clark Wilmot.
And Beth, what about you?
My name is Beth Evans. I am a banking and finance solicitor and a partner based in our Cardiff office, and I've been with the firm for just over 5 happy years.
Okay, now you're both on this podcast because you have had what we're calling life-changing experiences. So when did you realize that something had changed, either in your perception or your life?
This time was at the beginning of the first lockdown, so going back probably to April 2020, although I had had episodes of the condition that I have, which is OCD, before. But yeah, it was the beginning of the first lockdown. Everything was fine, you know, other than the fact that we were all in lockdown. I was working from home. My husband was working from home. We had everything that we needed. We've got a nice house. We had food. We've got no money worries. And it just came from nowhere. I just think that that is the way that I'm programmed, and that there are probably points in my life of extreme stress or actually sometimes the lack of it, when I've got nothing to worry about, that my mind sort of turns in on itself. And that's just the way I'm wired.
So was there a moment where you knew things were not okay?
Yeah, I was working at home. I think my husband had to go into the office, and I was looking at my screen thinking, I can't do this. And I literally slithered off my chair onto the floor, was on my hands and knees with my head on the floor thinking, what am I going to do? I just don't know how to fix this. I don't know where to turn, what to do.
How does OCD feel to somebody who doesn't understand that? Is it a building anxiety? What you've just described sounds a bit like a panic attack.
It manifests differently in different people. Still at that time, I didn't know that it was OCD. It took me a while and working with my therapist, who has been amazing, to actually be told, yeah, it's OCD. And that was actually quite helpful for me, because being able to put a name to it meant I knew what I was dealing with and I could follow some of the tried and tested routes that have helped people. There are different kinds of OCD. OCD is characterized by having intrusive thoughts, and everyone has intrusive thoughts. Everyone, you know, might be walking across a bridge and think, what if I just threw my car keys off there? And they'd think, oh, that's a funny thing to think. And then they just move on. For somebody with OCD, they attach significance to that thought. To use a similar example, I would have been walking across that bridge and thought, what if I throw myself off? You would think, what a funny thought, let's carry on. I would think, oh my God, that means I want to kill myself. That means I'm suicidal. Oh my God, I'm going to lose control, kill myself, and my family will be left without me. Your instinct is to try to suppress it, to try to push it down. Actually, what that does is just gives it more strength. And a lot of the therapy that I've had to treat this has been around not engaging with the thought, just accepting that it's there and moving on and carrying on with what you're doing. And it's a form of CBT, it's a form of cognitive behavioral therapy. For me, CBT was the best option because it gave me a route to live with the thoughts and not engage with them and not attach any significance to them. By doing it and by succeeding at doing that, you actually reduce the severity and the frequency of the thoughts anyway. But OCD generally is the kind of the existence of any intrusive, unwanted thoughts that trouble the person that's having them, that they attach significance to, and which you then perform compulsions to try to get rid of. So it's obsessive compulsive disorder. So the obsessiveness is the thought. The compulsion is what you do to try to get rid of that thought. So for someone with germ OCD, that might be compulsively washing your hands. For me, my compulsions were mental, but they're no less debilitating for being mental rather than physical.
Hugely insightful, really compelling. Thank you very much, Beth. We'll come back to you in a sec. Martin, if I can ask you, that life changing event. Can you remember that instance?
Yeah, I can. It was something that hit me like a ton of bricks. I talk about my beautiful breakdown, and it was an experience of a breakdown just over 20 years ago now, when I was in my 30s, and I was walking to work on a pretty sunny morning down the Gloucester Road in Bristol, one of the main arteries into the centre of Bristol. And I got to a point on that road called the Arches, which anyone who's in Bristol will probably know the Arches. And I found myself stuck to the pavement, stood still, and in floods of tears, and not really understanding why I was stuck still and in floods of tears. But I had broken down. Probably stood there for a number of minutes. I can't remember now. At some point, managed to turn myself around and went home and managed to phone my boss at work and said to him, or describe what had happened and say, look, I don't think I'll be in work today. I didn't see it coming, but with hindsight, I can now look back and say, actually, it was coming probably for 3, 4, 5 years. There was a progression of high levels of stress, anxiety, depression that led to a point where I just felt I couldn't actually go any further on that day. Actually, I feel fortunate. I had a great boss, a guy called Ian, who jumped in his car and drove up the Gloucester Road to our family home and sat with me and talked to me. Said, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're not coming to work. You're not coming to work for the foreseeable future. You're not well. We need to get you some treatment. And he was amazing. And he arranged for some counseling for me that over a period of weeks and then months enabled me to get my feet back on the ground and work out what had happened and what had led to this moment and pick myself up and start to move forward.
So obviously this was a hugely important moment. I love that term, my beautiful breakdown, obviously as a result of what you've learned since or how you've evolved since. And what was the impact of your breakdown on your loved ones and the people around you?
So Anna, my ex, still, good friends many, many years after having been apart. At the time, I don't think she understood, if I'm honest. Up until that point, to Anna and to my family and to my friends, I would have been that eternally positive, optimistic, happy, successful, outgoing individual. And that is what I was. At that moment in time, I don't think Anna or my close friends and family who were aware of what had happened really understood what had happened. It's only been latterly that I think I've really fully explored with the individuals close to me the impact of that experience.
Did you understand what was happening to you when it happened?
No, not at all. I mean, I was completely floored. I was very fortunate that Ian, my boss, his degree was a psychologist. He'd subsequently married a PhD psychologist, and Ian was quite special in helping me to start to understand that I was unwell, but that I was quite capable of getting well, but for that to happen, that I needed some treatment. I had an individual there who was close to me, who was able to understand aspects of what might be going on.
Brilliant. Thank you. Beth, back to you. We've heard how Martin's loved ones, the people close to him, didn't quite understand what he was going through. How was it for you? It's a little bit more recent. Your young daughter, your husband, how did they react initially?
The problem with anything like this when it happens to you is that to you it feels so momentous and so earth-shattering that you can't conceive of how it couldn't affect everybody else around you. You know, I say to my husband, I say, oh God, wasn't it awful? Or, wasn't it horrendous when I was this, when I was that? And he says, well, I know you're real, but you weren't that bad. Even though some days it was a massive struggle to get out of bed, I made sure I did that and had a, wash and brush my teeth. I didn't always look particularly attractive, but I did those things. So I think because you're in it, it feels so gigantic that you can't conceive of it not having a horrible effect on everybody else. I was really conscious of the effect that it was having on my daughter, for example, and not doing the things and being the person that I normally was. But that was probably quite common to people with anxiety, another layer of stress. She was never hungry. She always had clothes and food, and she always knew I loved her. So it wasn't like she was being mistreated. I think I just wanted to be the mum I'd been before. And it took me a while to come to terms with the fact that at the moment I wasn't. To summarize, I think it had an effect on them, and I think that they were worried about me, but I don't think they were ever as worried as I thought they were about me. It feels like it's all centered on you. and you feel like you're the center of this kind of storm. And actually, other people have got their own storms going on, and it's not quite so earth shattering for them.
Beth, if I can just comment, one of the things you just mentioned there was that sense of it all feeling so gigantic. In the build-up, if I now look back, that is a very good description, Beth, because everything just seemed to become so gigantic, so enormous, and so weighted on me. A lot of my challenges, I think, were based around the experiences I was having in work. I loved my work, but I'd been promoted probably too quickly, and I was out of my depth. And I guess that 3 to 5 year period leading up to the breakdown, I would now characterize as just, well, myself putting more and more expectation on myself that I could just sort all of this stuff out. I could manage it. I could control it. There was a big element of wanting to control stuff and feeling that surely if I just chucked more of my energy and more of my personality at all of these challenges, somehow it will get sorted out. Actually, almost you've got to maybe try and take less responsibility for some things, actually. Start sharing responsibility with more people. You can't control everything. You certainly can't control people. So if you're working in an organization, in a complex organization where people want different things and have different preferences, to think that you can control those situations is madness in itself.
But going through therapy and finding out you're not actually that important, you're not that crucial. You are to a few people, but really, the world will keep turning is really freeing.
So Martin, you touched on it there, and Beth, you have as well. But diagnosis and treatment, we'll bundle those all up together. How did that happen? And was it important to you to hear a clinical diagnosis? Did that give you a sense of peace about what the process you were going through? Beth, I'll go to you first.
I had been on antidepressants previously, so I kind of recognized the signs this time around, even though I still didn't have a name for it, but you know, I'm anxiety. So I spoke to the GP and asked to go back on some antidepressants again. So I went back on the same ones that I had been on before, which were called citalopram. And about 3 or 4 weeks after that, I had some sort of reaction and nobody can tell me why it happened. So I went to A&E and I spoke to an amazing doctor there and he said, find some pills that work and get some CBT. That was like a key moment that stuck in my mind, that doctor. He said, have you thought about killing yourself? And I was like, well, that's my whole thing. He said, yeah, don't worry, you're not going to kill yourself. Don't worry. I followed the advice of the A&E doctor and found someone who specialized in the sort of things that I thought I was suffering from, even though I didn't know at that time it was OCD. So it took about a period of probably 6 months for me to find the right pills. And in the meantime, my therapy was ongoing and that was all done remotely because obviously we were in during the pandemic. It took from kind of June to January this year for me to start thinking, I feel a bit better today. Saying that I feel a bit better today, that was one of the things that my therapist has always cautioned me against, is this concept of better and worse, how I was then, how I am now, getting back to normal, whatever normal is. He was very gently trying to introduce me to the concept of mindfulness. And mindfulness, I think, mindfulness in its simplest form is just living in the moment, not dwelling on the past and not worrying about the future, but just sort of accepting things how they are now. Just in general terms, I think it's something that everyone should do and not just people who have an episode like I did. It goes back to control and what Martin was saying. There are things you can't control. There's no point in dwelling on them. Just focus on where you are now.
So I've never actually had a formal diagnosis. I guess what I learned through many years of counseling, what I learned during that period was that I was certainly prone to periods of both depression, but also mania. And what was quite clear is that I had a pretty major breakdown. But similarly to Beth, I was spending too much of my time dreaming or talking about things that were way in the future. Things were all going to be all right when I'd done this or when I'd achieved that or when I'd bought this thing or done this or when the kids. It's interesting, Beth, to hear you mention that, you know, because I hadn't, until you said it, connected that up actually with mindfulness as I hear it talked about today. But there are several lessons that I guess I learned from that very early counseling that has stuck with me ever since, just to try and live a little bit more in today. If things are a little bit of a roller coaster, I think, you know, the last month or so has probably been one of the tougher periods actually that I've had in the last decade probably. And I'm actually preparing to have this conversation today has made me reflect on that. in a way that I probably wouldn't otherwise. So, you know, really helpful.
Do you think the effect of the pandemic, there's a general sense that everything is on hold, so therefore perhaps you are forced to look for things that will occur in the future for that positive uplift? Do you think perhaps that stops us going through that mindfulness process?
I would have said the opposite at first, actually, to be honest, Ed, and my experience of the pandemic up until relatively recently, actually, be that there was just so much stuff that had to be sorted in the early days of the pandemic from a work and family perspective. Everything actually was very much today, tomorrow, the next day. But I think as time has gone on in the last few months, I've definitely found myself thinking a lot more about what I'm going to do in 2022 or 2020. When this whole bloody thing's over, perhaps there is more an element of that.
Beth, you touched on this, but how has your life changed since then? Is there anything else that you want to touch on there?
Not directly related to that, but one thing I should just mention in relation to medication, and I'm not saying that that's the right thing for everybody. I think it's very subjective and that everybody needs to make their own decision. For me, it felt like I needed something to get me back up to some sort of level of stability before the therapy could have its full effect. And the analogy that I use in that respect is I felt like the meds were my plaster cast for my broken leg, but the therapy was my physio after the plaster came off. Because I know that some people, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly, have a bit of a thing about not wanting to be on antidepressants. I've accepted that I'm on them and I'm probably going to be on them for the rest of my life. That's fine. That's absolutely fine with me. In terms of what's changed me as a person, like Martin refers to his beautiful breakdown, you know, there are so many positives that have come out of this. I wouldn't want not to have gone through it because I think it's made me a kinder, more considerate person. It's certainly allowed me to look at the way I'm living my life and what I'm contributing and what's important to me. There is a group called Mental Health Mates set up by a lady called Bryony Gordon. And the idea was that you are able to meet up with people who are in a similar position to you and just go for a walk with them and talk about what you're going through or talk about what box set you're watching. Like, just talk. And there wasn't one in Cardiff. So since then, I've set up a Cardiff one that on the last walk, there were about 8 or 9 of us. That's something that wouldn't have happened. There are many reasons why I wouldn't change what I've been through.
Brilliant. Thank you. Martin, would you change anything?
No, I have to echo everything that Beth has said there. I absolutely wouldn't change anything. The biggest, or maybe the two biggest changes, is that recognition now that I can't always control things, and sort of being accepting of that, whether that be in a professional capacity or in a personal private capacity, has really changed how I think about day-to-day challenges or week-to-week challenges. But mostly the thing I wouldn't change is exactly as Beth described, being able to open up a conversation or be open to a conversation with somebody else who's facing some sort of challenge. It'll always be different to the challenge that I was facing, but some sort of mental health challenge, and being able to actually just have one-to-one conversation with that individual that can perhaps help them, even if it's just in understanding that, blimey, there are other people, you know, around me, at Clark Wilmot in the workplace or friends in my private life, male friends in particular, I have to say, but actually, you know, being available to have a conversation with them and them then understanding that they can take some action. You know, they can go to see their GP or they can seek some support from a counselor of some description. I wouldn't change that for anything. That, you know, some of the best conversations and the most valuable conversations I've had in the last 15 to 20 years have all been as a result of these experiences. And simply wouldn't change that for anything.
Beth, I hear your dog has joined us. How's the dog?
You're on top form, aren't you? Yeah, top form. The only thing I would add to that is that I think doing things like that, I think we've come an enormously long way, as we touched on at the moment, in terms of the stigma of mental health issues. I still think there's a long way to go. Mental health issues, I think, are still largely misunderstood, particularly OCD. Like I said, I had no idea that I had OCD. When people say I'm a little bit OCD, it makes me want to kill because it is so harmful. you're not a little bit OCD. You can't be a little bit obsessive compulsive disorder. You just like things straight. I like things straight. I've also got, you know, debilitating and intrusive and disturbing thought patterns. I can tell you which one I prefer. It's not the latter. It drives me crackers. And I think, you know, that is just one example of, oh, like, oh my God, he was completely bipolar. I mean, I don't have bipolar, but I can imagine how difficult and hurtful that must be to somebody who actually has. And I don't want to be a snowflake about it, but I think we do need to recognize that people who battle with these conditions, these debilitating, difficult conditions on a daily basis, you don't need to hear that.
One of the things that I'm really now aware of is that I have some physical symptoms that when they start to manifest are a really helpful flag for me to be aware that actually this is probably linked to the fact that I'm entering a phase where I am depressed or that I'm struggling more than I should be and that I need to really think about those lessons that I learned through my counseling. So, for example, I suffer a little bit from eczema, but I only suffer from eczema when I'm pretty down and I'm pretty exhausted and I'm not looking after myself and not doing the right things. And so, you know, I have eczema at the moment. Maybe I need to be thinking about what the hell is going on. Also, I'm a lifelong exerciser. I haven't done any exercise for probably 3 months. And I've got eczema. For Christ's sake, Martin, there's two of your flags that tell you that you're not looking after yourself right now in the way that you should be. So I think that as you become more aware of your own mental health and of the challenges you have, if there are those physical attributes, those physical experiences that go alongside it, just being really cognizant of those and then listening and then doing something to respond.
And not just relying on meds and therapy, I think. So much of it has to come from you and it's boring stuff. Self-care. So exercising, like Martin said, doing things that make you happy. You know, I discovered gardening and knitting during last episode, making sure that you eat right. I've given up alcohol, which actually I think has had the single biggest change, had the single biggest improvement to my mental health on an ongoing basis. I now don't get anxiety and I don't get alcoholia the next day. And that has been really, really helpful.
The fact that I haven't had a big crash in 20 years, I don't think means that there won't necessarily be another one. But I'd like to think I've got better tools that I'm aware of that help me manage it better.
Tools is the thing, isn't it? And tools are therapy, tools are medication, tools are also Absolutely. Going for a run, looking yep. at a tree.
Throwing paint at a canvas, Beth.
Yeah, yes, that's helped you, isn't it? Loads.
That's been great, yeah.
Go to the top of a mountain. When you're standing on the top of a mountain, you can kind of see how insignificant your problems are really in this big wide world.
But even that's an interesting comment, I think, because when I get to the end of each year, typically around, you know, New Year's time, you're looking back. When I think of all the best days I've had in the year leading up to that point, there are almost inevitably days where I've been stood on a mountain or stood yeah. on a beach or stood on a yeah, whatever. Yeah. They're very useful reminders, I think.
I agree.